You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Well, we're back again. And now, this week, exciting week. No events. First of all, I'd like to thank all those people who turned up at the West Papuan Wren Collective gathering on Sunday. It's good to see so many West Papuans there, as well as other supporters. And just remind you that we'll be having another gathering before the end of the year, near Christmas, which you're all invited to. So I'll let you know of that date as soon as I find that out. Now, next Wednesday, I think today's the 3rd, if I remember correctly, next Wednesday, which is the 10th, we will be having dinner at the restaurant, a South American restaurant, down in Brunswick at the corner of Breeze Street and Albion Road. Can't miss it. Come and join us. That's next Wednesday night. There's only one stipulation: you pay for your own food and drinks. The following Wednesday at Footscray Hotel. Now, I know you may not realise this, but the 11th of November marks a number of important occasions. But one of the most recent one was the dismissal, the illegal dismissal of the Whitlam-led Labor government on the 11th of November 1975. So that makes it the 50th anniversary this year. Now, if you look at all the reforms that have been passed by the Australian Parliament since 1901 to 1925, in the 3.5 years, almost 4 years, that the Whitlam Labor government was in power, they passed more reforms empowering people than all the other Australian governments combined. So we're going to have a people's picnic on the steps of the Victorian Parliament House on Tuesday, the 11th of November, to which you're all invited to, starting at midday. Bring food, drinks and musical instruments. But on the 17th, I'll be doing a presentation at the Footscray Hotel at 48 Hopkins Street in Footscray on those reform initiatives which flew out of the Whitlam-led Labor government. Not because of the government, because of the pressure from the Australian population for change. So we'll look at that on the 17th, and on the 24th, we'll be having dinner down at Frankston. Now, obviously, you can always join us at Public Housing Everybody's Business Vigils, which are on the steps of the Victorian Parliament House every Thursday between midday and 1 p.m. It's interesting that our friends in the anti-immigration movement think the housing issue is all about migration. We'll look at that in the program in a few seconds' time. The sacred cows have come in, they're chanting, they're saying, well, I don't know what they're saying. I think they're speaking in Hindi. Well, they are chanting, so we'll see what they say. But there's a lot of things happening. You know what's happening around the traps today. People need support. I encourage you to visit Camp Sovereignty and at the King's Domain. People need support, so let's get together. It's important that we support each other in this period. This is nothing new. It's happened many times before. Here we go. The satellite is upon us. We're about to join the Community Radio Network down in Sydney Tower. My name's Joseph Toscano. I'm hosting today's program of The Anarchist World This Week. The Anarchist World This Week is podcast. You can access the podcast by going to 3cr.org.au. That's 3cr.org.au. If you wonder what anarchy is all about, anarchos without rulers. Not without rules, without rulers. What gives rulers the ability to determine the lives of billions of people? Inequalities in power and wealth. So the anarchist struggle is the struggle to devolve or share power and the struggle to hold wealth in common. It's very simple. It's not about religious belief, political belief, whatever. It's about sharing power, holding wealth in common. How we get there is a matter for debate. That's what the anarchist struggle is all about. Now, we're going to, you may want to switch off today because I'm going to use some horrible things. They're called facts. Now, I know people, it is the 21st century. It's the end of the first quarter of the 21st century. And people really don't like facts anymore because it seems to, you know, interfere with their blinkered ideological beliefs. But facts. Now, we saw some anti-mass, in inverted commas, migration rallies across the country. I think it was about 15,000 people, maybe 20 across the country. Significant number. And they tried to make this connection between migration and housing affordability. Because, see, when you organise these rallies and you've got a different agenda, what you need to do is you need to have some type of platform where you can actually get people to join you. And it all sounds very good, doesn't it? Mass migration. They've taken away our jobs. They're taking away our homes. They're taking away our, you know, our country. Seems to be the big rallying cry. They're going to replace us. Well, we'll talk about who us are in a minute. So, does migration have an impact on housing? Now, it would seem obvious that migration would have an impact on housing, but that's not the issue. The issue is, why do we find ourselves in this situation? Now, people who come here, whether they're asylum seekers or come here through, you know, migration thing, are not at fault. That's not the issue. The issue is why. And about 20 years ago, a number of Liberal National Party governments were concerned about the strength of trade unionism in this country. And a great way to dilute the capacity of trade unions to have an impact on Australian society is to bring in people to do that work. It's very simple. When you look at the visa system and the way it was designed to assist owners of businesses to decrease their costs by importing people who in the majority of cases wouldn't be in a position to join a trade union as they are on temporary work visas. So what you do is you put downward pressure on wages. Now, this is nothing new. This has been happening through all post-colonial Australian history. You place downward pressure on wages. Initially, we had convicts. You didn't pay them. Then you had, you know, different waves of migrants who were allowed, if they were the right colour, they were allowed to come into the country to do the work that other people found they didn't want to do because of the poor working conditions and the poor wages. So it's nothing new in Australia to actually bring in people to do poorly paid work and at the end of that period offer them citizenship as a reward. It's nothing new. But has that got anything to do with the housing crisis? Now, when you look at it, initially you would think, yes, the more people that come in, the greater the pressure on housing. But let's not forget that many of the people who are marching or protesting on Sunday, as far as migration was concerned, are in a position where they can't actually afford housing. See, housing, We have a housing crisis in this country, not because of migration, because of government policies at the state and federal level, which have turned residential housing into an investment project through negative gearing and through other initiatives. Housing is not a mechanism via which people have shelter. Housing is a mechanism via which people are able to increase their return if they're investors. This has caused a dramatic increase in housing prices. At the same time, as far as housing is concerned, what we've seen is state and federal governments moving away from providing public housing, publicly owned and publicly managed, for people whose income level means they will never be able to buy in the private housing market. Although migration may have a minimal impact on housing affordability and the housing crisis, the major impact has come from government legislation, which has seen state and federal governments move away from public housing and providing state-owned and state-managed housing to people who cannot afford to buy in the private housing market, because the private housing market has been turned into an investment orgy through government legislation. So when we see people marching in the streets against mass migration, the fact is that it's not migration which has caused their issues. Their issues, whatever they may be, and I'm talking about the majority of protesters, their issues, whatever they may be, are not linked to the number of people that come into this country, but are linked to the fact that we live in a capitalist society where a small number of people own the means of production, distribution, exchange and communication, and the creation of an investment class, about 8 to 9% of the Australian population, has created a marketplace which is totally dominated by the private sector. When a particular aspect of existence is dominated by the private sector, we see the formation of conglomerations and corporations, duopolies and monopolies. We see an increase in costs for people who require goods and services. So to blame somebody who has come here either seeking asylum or through, you know, migration channels for the situation we find ourselves in as a country is ludicrous. Totally ludicrous. Now, obviously, there are elements in the mass migration movement who are enabled, and that's the key word, enabled by significant institutions and influential individuals in this country. Although the impact of these changes has been hijacked by groups which call themselves neo-Nazis. Now, I know, I've known real neo-Nazis in my time. These aren't neo-Nazis. These are Adolf's freaks. That's right. Because in these situations, what we are seeing is the elevation of a minuscule minority even smaller than the anarchist movement, of a minuscule minority into some type of political actor. These are not a political actor. They think by creating situations and increasing tension, and this is nothing new in terms of strategy, that somehow people will flock to their ranks, and they will, like Adolf, be able to create this mass movement which will eventually capture state power and impose their will on the population at large. But the fact is, it's not Adolf's freaks we should be concerned about. They are nothing more than the tip of an iceberg which has been enabled by a host of influential institutions in this country and individuals, not just in the political parties you would expect this type of ideological rubbish to be accepted as reality, but in terms of people who have exercised power. All you've got to do is look at Murdoch's Fox News in this country, and I recommend you don't because you may vomit, to see how the climate is created for Adolf's freaks to actually gain some type of notoriety and attention and possibly political mileage in the Australian community. Because, you know, it's a very simple tactic to divide us as a people, whether it's religion, whether it's the funny clothes we wear, whether it's our sexual orientation, whether it's our gender, whether it's our race, the colour of our skin, the language we speak, the gods we worship or don't worship. It's easy to pick the low-hanging fruit, the people you can identify on the streets. But the fact is, to describe these people as neo-Nazis is to give them political credibility. They are not neo-Nazis, they're Adolf's freaks. I'm not saying they're not dangerous. Obviously they're dangerous, as we've seen. But they're Adolf's freaks. That's all they are. Nothing more. The fact is, the best way, although we've now seen the state government of Victoria begin to act, the best way to deal with this situation is mockery. Mockery. Because to give them credibility by describing their musings, their utterances, as somehow denoting some type of political ideology only helps them to grow. They need to be mocked for what they are. They're nothing more than Adolf's freaks, wannabes, wannabe Adolfs, somehow thinking that the Australian population or sections of the Australian population are going to join their ragtag organisations and come out with their flagpoles and sticks and iron bars and intimidatory tactics. It's not just a matter of actually standing up to them physically, but it's a matter of humiliating them as an organisation, humiliating their ideas, mocking them for what they are. They're nothing more than Adolf's freaks. And for me, I won't use the term neo-Nazis. I think it's an insult to neo-Nazis to describe these freaks that we see running around the streets pretending to be real neo-Nazis with their, you know, balaclavas, their sunglasses, their little black uniforms, their gym-honed, you know, karate kicks, as some type of credible political actors. We make them credible political actors by giving them the limelight. The fact is, they're nothing. Obviously, they're a big enough force in their own little minuscule way to terrorise, and that's the key word, to terrorise other small groups in society. But in terms of their ability to actually change the political dynamic, there is no ability to change the political dynamic unless their enablers continue to support them. And what we need to do is we need to expose their enablers, those politicians who use the rhetoric of hate in order to promote their pathetic ideological agendas or their personal agendas, those organisations like the Institute of Public Affairs, which over decades has created a climate which allows Adolf's freaks to, you know, gain public attention. I mean, you may not realise that this whole anti-migration rally business got a little bit of a kick start when the Institute of Public Affairs published figures which, true to 2025 fact and fiction, you know, criterias regarding mass migration in this country, which had nothing to do with reality. It seems they can't count. And as I said before, you've got elements in Fox News, you've got elements in the corporate-owned media, you have elements in the in society who somehow think by creating divisions based on what are relatively innocuous differences will somehow improve their political fortunes in the community. Now, it's very funny. I thought it a little bit funny when we heard them talk about wanting their country back. We want our country back. Adolf's freaks and their hanger-oners want their country back. Well, I may be approaching an age where dementia is going to play a major issue in my life, but the fact is, anybody with one synapsing neuron in their little brain who thinks that their country has been taken away by migrants is deluded. Now, obviously, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders in this community make the claim over and over again that although they had lived here for over 65,000 years, that their country had been taken away and they want their compensation for their losses. That's a fact. But the fact is, it's not our country. This country doesn't belong to you and me. This country belongs to the 1% that own the means of production, distribution, exchange and communication, and to a lesser extent the investment classes in our society. They call the shots. If they didn't call the shots, why would a country as rich as Australia in terms of resources and intellect find itself facing the same issues which only raise week in and week out. Childhood poverty. One third of the country living on inadequate social security benefits. A housing crisis. A health crisis. Infrastructure crisis. How have we got it so wrong? And it's not the fact that migrants are to blame. I mean, ultimately, we're all boat people apart from this country's First Nations people. We all came on boats. And those of you who think that migrants don't play a role in this country's economy, especially in the worst paying jobs, I'd just like to share personal experiences with you. So I think it's important that people understand the important role, especially in the healthcare and aged care sector, that migrants play in terms of providing services to a rapidly increasing ageing population, which has multiple chronic health issues. Now, I've been working with people with profound disabilities, secondary to trauma, for over 50 years. And what I've seen, as far as the care provided to this increasing number of people, I saw it yesterday, going from house to house, what you see is the recent immigrant cohort providing the bulk of the services. Because of the poor wages, we find that Australian workers would prefer not to work in that industry. And although many of the companies which provide those workers are owned by Europeans, we find that the workforce is almost exclusively non-European because of the conditions, the wages, the part-time nature of the work, the lack of an ability to create a career in that type of work. And we see this across aged care facilities around this country, and we see it increasingly in early childhood development centres, because these centres are run by the private sector and they need to maximise their profits. And you maximise your profits by decreasing services to the people you supposedly look after and by squeezing your workforce. That's the only way you make a profit in these sectors. It's not as if you're manufacturing something which everybody wants. So if these people want their country back, and I can understand because of all the issues they face, isn't it about time they actually looked at the reality, not the fiction? The reality is that power and wealth in this country does not lie in the hands of the people or the government of the day. Power and wealth and the type of legislation which goes through Parliament ultimately relies on that small section of society that owns the means of production, distribution, exchange and communication. That's why we have billionaires and multimillionaires in this country and people trying to live on a Newstart allowance. That's the reality. And I know facts and figures are just not de rigueur in 2025, but the reality is that is the reality. And if you want to have some ideological wet dream with Adolf's freaks regarding the fact that it's, you know, oppressed minorities who are the country's main issue, well then, what can I say? What can I say? You're nothing more than disposable storm troopers for that small section of society that owns the means of production, distribution, exchange and communication. Listen to the Anarchist World this week, broadcast across Australia by the Community Radio Network. This program is streaming live on 3cr.org.au. The program is podcast. You can access the podcast by going to 3cr.org.au. My name's Joseph Toscani. And remember, it's up to you whether you give these people any credibility. Mockery is the way forward.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
Let's move on. Now on the weekend, has the convener of the West Papuan Rent Collective, and what we do is we raise money for the West Papuan Independence Movement to have one of the few offices in the world based here in Collins Street in Melbourne, to coordinate their political and military struggle in the West Papuan province. And the West Papuan Rent Collective basically consists of, you know, extraordinary human beings. Not rich, not powerful, but extraordinary human beings who are willing to put a dollar a day aside to pay the rent on the West Papuan Independence Office, which gives West Papuan activists, both here and overseas, the ability to coordinate their independence struggle. Independence struggle that's been going on for over 60 years since Indonesia incorporated West Papua into Indonesia. Now, remember when, you know, remember the good old president, the father of 2 million dead, you know, President Suharto, the dictator of Indonesia, who was elevated to the supreme office by the United States after the murder within 6 to 8 weeks of over almost 2 million, that's right, 2 million Indonesians who were said to be communists or communist super sympathisers. Now, Suharto had a son-in-law, and he was quite brutal. And at one stage, he was designated a war criminal, not as we see in Gaza that being designated a war criminal, or as we see in Russia, being designated a war criminal does anything as far as your reputation is concerned. It may even improve it. You know, he spent some time, I think it was in Lebanon, you know, away from Indonesia. But he was recently, a year ago, elected, Mr. Subiakto, elected as president of Indonesia. And I remember Mr. Albanese rushed over to congratulate him, somehow forgetting his shameful record in East Timor and his shameful record as Suharto's son-in-law in Indonesia, a military dictatorship. Now, since he's been elected to office, the lad's been trying to consolidate his power in the Indonesian military, because El Presidente realises that ultimately, if he wants to break the control, a handful of families, a handful of oligarchs have over Indonesia, he needs to take over the Indonesian military. And what he's done, although he promised to be, you know, a cuddly grandfather type when he was elected, bit like me, not that I'm a war criminal, the fact is that he's been consolidating his power by bribing various elements of the Indonesian society, especially the parliamentarians. Now, Indonesian people are going through a very difficult time economically. Very difficult. And they're seeing many of the gains they've made since 1998 when the Suharto regime was overthrown go by the wayside. And when they saw the current president try to bribed Indonesian parliament by, you know, giving them all these perks, they had enough. And over the last week, we've seen the burning of government buildings. We've seen the looting of parliamentarians' offices. And we've seen the president give the green light, speaking about treason, to the military to become embroiled in attempts to try to hose down these protests. But these protests are not just on the main island in Java. They're across the Indonesian archipelago. So in order to bolster his power, he's been promising the Indonesian military to create 100 new battalions. You see, the Indonesian military has a very, very proud history. And that proud history has been assisted by Australia, especially the Australian Defence Forces, which continues to train them in anti-insurgency programs, especially in their desire to try to eradicate the West Papuan people and the West Papuan independence movement. So what we're seeing is a move by the current president to join all those dictators which find themselves in Beijing waiting to celebrate the 80th anniversary of the end of World War II in the Pacific. But the problem is the president couldn't go. He couldn't stand near these authoritarians because he's concerned about what's happening in Indonesia, because the anger is palatable. And so more and more Indonesian people are beginning to understand the reality in West Papua, the fact there is one Indonesian soldier for every adult West Papuan male in West Papua to maintain order and control. They begin to understand that the Indonesian military is good for one thing, and that's to suppress its own people. That's been its role from its inception. So, keep your eye on our nearest neighbour. Maybe all those soft words and pleasant entreaties between Australia and Indonesia will begin to sour in the near future. You never know. You listen to The Anarchist World This Week, broadcast across Australia via the Community Radio Network. How petty. Now, I did mention a few weeks before the current sideshow in Beijing that the buffoon in Washington, the man they thought was dead but is now alive, he must have been resurrected, I think. What was his name? The bloke that was resurrected by Jesus Christ? I've forgotten his name. Maybe he was resurrected, but he's still there, they tell me. You know, the buffoon. He'd be a bit worried, wouldn't he? There's 8 billion people on the planet. There's about 350 million living in the United States of America, maybe 320 million. It's a divided country. Although the buffoon's trying to do all he can do to emulate his emulate his friends in Israel and China and North Korea and Russia. That's why he loves them so much. I think there'd be alarm bells going off in Washington. Now, what the buffoon has done is what nobody has been able to do for decades. By treating India as an enemy. I mean, everybody's an enemy as far as tariffs is concerned, aren't they? Slapping 50% tariffs on their goods because they bought Russian oil. Let's not forget that. India and China, which just a few years ago were fighting on their northern borders, have come together in a bromance. There they are in Beijing. President Modi, an increasingly authoritarian, you know, element in Indian politics. You know, the supreme leader, the paramount leader in China. He's got it down to a fine art as to keep power. You got Vladimir Putin, noted war criminal from Russia. Even got the little lad from North Korea and some other important people coming to watch a military parade to mark the 80th anniversary of the end of World War II in the Pacific. Now, I'm sure the lads and lasses in Washington would be concerned about the current situation, because through the buffoons' inadequate understanding of the world, and that the world doesn't need the United States of America, what they've been able to do is bring traditional enemies together and increase pressure from authoritarian elements on the United States of America. Ho-hum, they did elect him. And as I said after the election, good luck. But it's interesting. The people of the United States of America are beginning to fight back. Not just in terms of waiting for the midterm congressional elections in next year, which has been the buffoon and his friends have been trying to gerrymander, but in terms of actually standing up to the buffoon, as we recently saw in Chicago, as we've seen around the country, as people begin to understand that the agenda the buffoon in Washington is promoting is an agenda based on hatred and division, and no way, either in the short or long term, is somehow going to benefit the people in the land of the brave and the free. Yep, you're listening to The Anarchist World this week. Now, there are certain prophetic things in life. Well, there's The Anarchist World this week, but there's even things more prophetic and petty than The Anarchist World this week. Now, the PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization, which runs the West Bank, their leadership has been denied access to New York, to the United Nations. Now, people don't seem to understand the United Nations sits on the United States soil, and the United States government can at any time deny access to various people coming to represent their country in the United Nations. And currently, they have decided to deny access to the Palestinian leadership in the West Bank. How petty can you get? How petty are these things? Just extraordinary. While we have people in Gaza battling famine, mass murder, bombings, the death and injury of over 50,000 children from a population of 2 million, the wholesale destruction of an area half the size of Melbourne, and the continuing military campaign conducted by the Israeli Defence Forces claiming they need to do this in order to defend their borders, while genocide experts claim what is happening in Gaza is genocide, not short of genocide, but genocide. And the world sits on its fingers. The world sits on its fingers. We don't see ships from Russia or China or Britain or Australia or Belgium turning up on the outside Gaza, providing relief to the people of Gaza. No, we don't see that. We see us pass resolutions and say nice words, but the fact is, war criminals are war criminals are war criminals. And the great thing about being a war criminal, especially if you're a leader of a sovereign nation state, it doesn't matter what the criminal court in The Hague thinks of you. The fact is, you can prosper and profit through the excesses. Now, I understand the buffoon wants a Nobel Peace Prize, and he's been trying to get Ukraine and Russia to come to the negotiating table. Well, obviously, it hasn't been very successful because the lad has forgotten it's about politics, not about business, but it's understandable, all right? The art of the failed deal. But he could make himself, he could get a Nobel Prize tomorrow. If he said to the Israeli Prime Minister and Cabinet, enough is enough, we're going to stop all weapons supplies. I want you to halt the destruction in Gaza. And it happened, and it would. Because Israel, through its actions, is currently totally isolated around the world, including the Western world. Well, then guess what? He could get his Nobel Prize. Now, I know vanity is an important thing if you're a dictator. It's an important, you know, it's everything, isn't it, vanity, if you're a dictator. Now, think about it, Trumpy, the buffoon in Washington. Think about it. You want a Nobel Peace Prize? Do something where you have some influence. As we see currently in Beijing, the influence the United States of America has around the world is waning. It's disappearing. People are saying, bye-bye, USA. We don't need you. We can live without you. So if you're a real statesperson, stop the carnage in Gaza tomorrow. Rebuild the area. Tell the Israeli government where to go. Starve them of weapons. Starve them of support. And hey presto, you'd be worthy of a Nobel Peace Prize. You're listening to The Anarchist World This Week, broadcast across Australia by the Community Radio Network. This program is streaming live on 3cr.org.au. The program is podcast. Now, the 11th of November is an important day in Australian history, and it's an important day for four main reasons. And we usually forget the first three, but I'll go through them. The 11th of November, 1854, marked the date that the Ballarat Reform League was formed. The Ballarat Reform League was the organisation behind the Eureka Rebellion, which occurred on the 3rd of December 1854, and its after effects continue, believe it or not, to reverberate across this country. The 11th of November 1880 saw the hanging of Ned Kelly in the old Melbourne jail. On the eve of his hanging, over 6,000 people protested outside the jail. The 11th of November 1918 marks Armistice Day, the day to mark the end of the war to end all wars. There is an old saying, only the dead have seen the end of war as far as the human condition is concerned. Only the dead have seen the end of war. And let's not forget that in that war, Australia, which had a population of 5 million, 420,000, which is an extraordinary number, almost, what, 8% of the population, 20% of the male population, volunteered to fight for God, King and Country. Of those 420,000, over 60,000 died on the European killing fields. Another 60,000 died within 10 years of their war wounds when they returned to this country. And many of the survivors were ignored, marginalised by successive governments. And then we have the 11th of November, 1975. On the 11th of November, 1975, the Whitlam-led Labor government was dismissed by a tired and emotional Governor-General, Mr. Kerr. And Mr. Whitlam and his cabinet faced with the possibility of blood in the streets if they resisted the dismissal, decided to accept their fate. Now, those of us who were alive during that period will remember it's the Whitlam Labor government didn't come up with its reform agenda out of nowhere. That reform agenda was pushed forward by tens of thousands of Australians who were sick and tired of Liberal National Party governments. And within the 4 years that the Whitlam Labor government was in power, it passed more reforms to improve Australians' lives than we have seen at any time since Federation. Now, it's interesting how history is written by the winners. And we're consistently told the Whitlam-led Labor government was the worst government we've had since Federation. But the facts are, and I know facts are not palatable in 2025, we like to believe in myths and legends. The fact is, the number of reforms which impacted positively on the Australian people are extraordinary. And I'm hoping on the 17th of this month to hold a presentation at the Footscray Hotel in Melbourne, that's 48 Hopkins Street, Footscray, on the reforms that were initiated by the Whitlam-led Labor government as a result of the pressure it was under by ordinary Australians who believed that the time had come for them to benefit, that's right, benefit from the riches of this country. Now, on the 11th of November, and I'm encouraging people across the country to do this, on the 11th of November, 2025, the Anarchist Media Institute will be holding a picnic. Did you hear that? A picnic on the steps of the Victorian Parliament House. It's a Tuesday. The picnic will start at midday. Take a day off from work. Tell the boss you can't give a stuff about the King's birthday holiday and, you know, you'd prefer to take, you know, the 11th of November off and come and join us on the picnic, bring food and drinks and musical instruments. I'm encouraging people across the country to look at those reforms. Look at what's happened since 1975. Look at what's happened during the past 50 years during the deregulation, privatisation, corporatisation, globalisation tsunami which has swept over the country. Have a look at the facts in terms of the haves and the have-nots, in terms that now you need two people in a relationship to pay the rent or the mortgage over your head. The fact that we're more indebted today than we have ever been. So I'm encouraging you to hold picnics, vigils, demonstrations, whatever you like, across the country, every town, every city, every village. Because we are at a very critical juncture in our society. Do we blame the other for our dilemma? Or like in the Eureka Rebellion, which was an international rebellion where people of all colours and creeds and religions and came together to fight the common enemy, the British Empire. Are we going to be, you know, going to some ideological cul-de-sac because of Adolf's freaks out there, thinking that somehow dividing us was somehow is going to win us something? Or are we going to look at where real power lies? Why, as a society, we find ourselves in this situation? Why the future of our children and grandchildren is at risk? As leaders of the world parade and goose step and carry on while achieving nothing for their people, telling us to fight for the common good and for our country. Well, maybe if it was our country, we would fight for it. But it's not. And that's the reality we face. Ultimately, the responsibility is yours and mine. What type of society we create is ultimately determined what you and I are willing to do. So I encourage you to think. I encourage you to talk to the people around you. I encourage to you to get involved in activities and actions which will put Adolf's freaks and their enablers in the dustbin of Australian history. You've been listening to The Anarchist World This Week, broadcast across Australia by the Community Radio Network. This program has been streaming live on 3CR in Melbourne. The program is podcast. You can access the podcast by going to 3cr.org.au. You can leave pleasant messages on 0439 395 489. You can email us at info@pibsy.net or info@anarchistmedia.org. And the list goes on and on. Facebook pages, YouTube channels, it's all out there. What we need for you is to get out of your computer room, get away from your iPad, and get into the real world, because that's where change occurs. So all you internet warriors, protect your forefinger from RSI, rapid strain injury, repeat strain injury, and become active. Thank you once again for listening to The Anarchist World This Week, brought to you by the Community Radio Network in Sydney. Wonderful people. Without them, I wouldn't be able to talk to myself every week. Thank you once again for listening to The Anarchist World This Week on your local community radio station.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.